Okay. Two out of the four programs I was a part of when I was out in Colorado had to do with the shadow, the human shadow, the personal shadow and the collective shadow, more on the personal side. What do I mean by shadow? Well, the thing you cast that you're not aware of, the thing that trails, your own darkness that trails you and seems to have a form all to its own. And I'm mentioning that because I want to try to talk a bit about the shadow today. It's something I've talked about here before, so some of this might be a reminder of some things. But I want to ask a certain kind of question that has to do with Born for These Times, because the subtitle of that is Opportunities and Challenges. So today I want to talk about a challenge, and that is the shadow that we cast and what we might be asked now to face about the shadow. Because there is something intense going on right now in our culture that has to do with the human shadow. And to use another word, which is the main word I want to focus on today, the mechanism of scapegoating and sending out of the camp, so to speak, those who are other in any respect or in some respect. And that's a really hard thing to talk about because almost as soon as I bring it up, people are like, yep, that's what other people do. They scapegoat. And that's part of the challenge. So we want to ask something like, what is it? That's what I want to try to start with. What is scapegoating? Where does it come from? Why do we do it? And is there anything we can do about it? Because one of the funny things about being into depth psychology, like I'm into, is that just because you know it's there doesn't mean it goes away. We think that would be the case, but that's why you go to your therapist more than once. It doesn't seem to be something one can easily integrate. Robert Bly has this lovely image. He says, well, he has it too, well, he has millions, but he says, we spend the first half of our life taking a bunch of material and stuffing it into a long black bag we drag around behind us. And we're not aware that we're dragging it behind us. I'm adding that most of the time. He says, and every once in a while we get an opportunity to take something out of the bag and we go in the corner and we have to eat it. And that's the part we don't like. To eat it, to consume it, to digest it, for both its distasteful nature and the nutrients that it contains. It does actually contain nutrients. The hidden elements that are in your shadow have nutrients that you need for your life, believe it or not. It's not just a bunch of bad things I once thought about somebody. So that's what I want to hover around, is again the question of the shadow, because I think, you're not going to believe that I'm about to say this, but I'm going to rewind and not forget everything I just said. One of the phenomenons or upwellings that happened because of the Trump era has to do with shadow. All kinds of things just started coming out of hiding on both sides. And that's why I think something like a challenge is being presented to us as human beings and as a culture. And that's what I want to try to get at today. So I'm going to go I never go that fast, but forget everything I just said. I want to talk about where the phrase scapegoat comes from. I mentioned this once before, but if you don't know, it's worth repeating. It comes straight from Leviticus in the Torah, in the Hebrew Bible. And that's interesting, because Because people are always saying, aren't we beyond the Bible? Yet we go around using words like scapegoat. It's from the Bible. And once a year, around what's called the Day of Atonement, the Jewish people, they would have been probably called the people of Israel at the time, something like that, developed a ritual around the question of what do we do with the suffering that we feel and the suffering that we cause? The old-fashioned word for that is sin. What do we do with it? And now, the entire book of Leviticus is also wrestling with this question, but this particular day, which came every year, was a way of wrestling with what do we do with the suffering that we feel and experience and the suffering that we cause, both personally and communally, both the things that we know of and the things we don't. That's how sophisticated the Hebrew people were. It's one thing to say, I'm sorry for the things that I've done. What about the things I have no idea? The suffering that I've caused in the world. So they had a ritual once a year. Sounds like something that we might need. A ritual once a year that reminds us, brings us closer to the question of what do I do with my own suffering and the suffering that I cause? So it's a very elaborate ceremony, which takes a kind of wild imagination to appreciate, which I have. I think it's an awesome ceremony. And one element involved presenting two goats. Almost everything in the book of Leviticus around sacrifices involved two of something. Two doves, two bulls, two this, two that. There's a reason for that. And this involved two goats. So the goats were brought forth, and there are all these rituals. First, the priests had to cleanse themselves. The people had to cleanse themselves. All kinds of stuff involved there. That's not what I'm so interested in. But they would cast lots to see which goat was which. Meaning, you know, they throw some dice, their version of dice. And one goat was selected, and that would be what was called a kind of whole sin offering. They would kill the goat. Almost all sacrifices, by the way, in the Hebrew Bible were basically outdoor barbecues. I know, I'm serious. Like, they cut it up, and the priest had some, and the people had some. It was a ritual way of eating. This one was a little different. They sprinkled some blood around the temple, and then they burned up the whole thing outside the camp. Everything. As a way of acknowledging that I cause suffering, we cause suffering in the world. Their word would have been something like sin, betrayal, hardship, we cheat people, so forth and so on. I know none of you do any of those things, but the whole thing goes up and it's accepted like by God. That's the idea. The other goat was sent to something called the Azazel, which is a mysterious word in Hebrew, and no one knows really what it means, which now I'm going to tell you what scholars say it means. It has something to do with like the demon of the desert. It's probably the origin. Monotheism really didn't get going for a very long time, even in the Hebrew Bible. And I know that's not the common reading, but it's really true. So you had like a demon of the desert that needed to be appeased, and you had Yahweh in the temple. You had these two realities. And these two realities actually are very symbolic of life itself. You have the temple, which is order or logos, very clear cut, this boundary, this wall, you wear this kind of thing, you wash this particular way, and then the desert, which is chaos. You don't believe me that desert is chaos? If I drop you off in the middle of Sinai by helicopter, you would freak out. I mean, totally, completely freak out, especially if it was 100 during the day and 38 at night. That sounds kind of fun, actually. So chaos and order are in conversation. So anyway, my other point is the other goat, poor thing, now has all of the sins of the priest and all of the sins of the people symbolically placed on its head. And we know this from the Mishnah. They had this little, I won't go through all that they said, but this little prayer. They symbolically put the sin or sins or suffering, we could say, ways that we don't live up to our full potential, onto the goat and send the goat out into the wilderness. to wander around and die. So what's happening? It's symbolically placing all of your junk on something and sending it away. That's where the phrase comes from. That's the scapegoat. The goat that goes to Azazel was actually how it reads in Hebrew. But think about the power of that for a second. What if we did something like that? Like that was just part of the inauguration, all right? Right after they say a bunch of BS, then they say, okay, we mess up every single year enormously. We cause enormous amounts of suffering. Some of it we know of, some of it we don't. And we don't want to hold this, and we certainly don't want to put it on somebody else, so we'll put it on the goat or some other poor animal and send it out to the desert. You can already feel like how sophisticated that is psychologically, can't you? And it's not once in a lifetime. It's every year they get together and they do this thing. So that phrase, of course, was co-opted by Western culture and who knows, contemporary psychology probably. And you get what happens now with scapegoating. Let me be very clear. It's when you put your stuff, either your own suffering or the cause of suffering, on somebody or something and send them out of the camp. And if you think, if I could just get rid of, now we're talking usually about a person or a people group, of so-and-so, I won't have to deal with it anymore. That was the idea with the scapegoat. The scapegoat didn't wander back in like after a few days, like, hey, I'm hungry now. In fact, well, I won't go into detail, but the priests made sure that the goat didn't come back because that would be terrible. Oh, he's back. Ah! All right. And you have to ask a kind of a question of culture. What do we do with our sin, our misdeeds, our blame, our jealousy, our misgivings, our suffering? What do we do with all that stuff? Because no therapist gets paid enough to absolve all of that. It's a constant struggle, unless you never cause suffering, which I doubt. Am I making sense about the need for at least this conversation? All right, so this is an aside. I could write a book on this. No one would read it, but this is an aside. One of the things that happened with Christ as a symbol from a theological point of view is that in some respects, Jesus was turned into the scapegoat. That's why most Christians will read the crucifixion as a kind of sacrificial symbol. And it happens outside of Jerusalem. There are some parallels outside Jerusalem, taken outside the camp, just like the goat was taken outside the camp. And it actually says this in the New Testament. The sins were upon him, something like that. And he sacrificed. And there's a redemptive element in that idea. Where did that come from? Well, it comes from the scapegoat. It comes from a few other sacrificial ideas in the Hebrew Bible anyway. But now, if that was the case, that those who followed Jesus, so to speak, put their misgivings, their capacity for suffering, all on Jesus, and sent Jesus out of the camp, you'd think it would alleviate than the followers of Jesus from ever doing that sort of thing, meaning continuing to scapegoat. You would think it would work that way. Guess what? It didn't work. It didn't work at all, in fact, we could say. The biggest example of that is how the Jewish people were treated by Christians, mostly, which is they're the problem, they're to blame. We should send them out of the camp to be a scapegoat. Question is, scapegoat for what? And this is why I'm saying no one will read my book, but here's an aside. The Jewish people, to a certain extent, represent a seed of doubt that most Christians can't own. because they said, oh, Jesus seems like a nice guy. I don't think he's the Messiah. Do you hear the doubt in the Christian narrative? Well, if you're into scapegoating, which all of us are at a certain low level of consciousness, then we say, that's the problem. No way I doubt. There's no way I have a seed of doubt. I know that I know. I'm a believer. I'm in the in-group. And if I can take that seed of doubt and send it away, then I'll be free. Does it make sense? As a mechanism. So I'm mentioning that now because this is what opens the door to what I want you to think about. The stuff you cannot own, your own doubts, your own anger, your own jealousy, even all your own golden stuff, that's a whole other conversation. Your own wild gifts, your uniqueness, your creativity. It's much easier to have somebody else carry that than for you to carry it. Because it's risky. It's risky if you own up to your own stuff. In fact, sometimes you don't even know it's there. Am I making some sense so far? Okay. So, I'm going to list some things about why we do this. And I'm speaking mostly psychologically here. We repress contents we dislike and dread. That's why we do it. We repress contents we dislike and dread early on. Why? Because we want to be accepted. That's why. It's that simple. So it goes down into the basement. We disown anything we feel is destructive to our ego's position. Right? We disown anything that is destructive to my own ego's position. Like the example I just used. I'm a believer. You almost know the more someone says I'm a believer and has to keep saying it, they're filled with doubt. But it's not obvious to the person, correct? They're firmly in a kind of screen or cloud. And it would threaten our ego's position if I had to say, actually, probably the best thing psychologically the Pope could do for global Christianity is say, every day I get up and I'm filled with doubt and I don't know if God is real. What would that do for people? It would soften them to the point where they say, well, actually, me too. It cracks the facade for a second. Okay. Another thing that happens, why we repress, is that we refuse consciousness of the extreme force of evil itself. We don't want to look at that, in other words. We don't want to look at evil. I mean, how many of you were like this morning, got up and say, I just really want to look at my evil and the evil in the world? We don't. And that's actually, there's good reason for that. So it just goes into the basement. That's all I'm saying. It goes into the basement. And every once in a while, it comes roaring out of the basement when we find a group, usually, or a person on which we can place all the evil. It's in them. It's certainly not in me, but it's in them. Making sense so far? Okay. So I'm basically mentioning, or I'm basically describing what happens psychologically to us, which is a kind of split. I won't go into tremendous detail in here, but it's just part of growing up. It's part of human consciousness. We are confronted with things that are very hard to be confronted with, like the complexity of our own nature, and so we split off. Everyone does it. Everyone. It's part of childhood. We split off. We separate ourselves from it. The question is, do we stay there or not? Do we stay in that split off space forever? The in-group and the out-group, the righteous and the unrighteous, the pure, the impure, those who are vaccinated, those who are not. Hear the purity dimensions of camps like that? And therefore create a kind of scapegoat mechanism. Or do we find ways, like Robert Bly says, to go into the corner, take things out of our black bag, and eat a bit of shadow? It's easier said than done. Okay. Now, this, I'm going to say one more thing about this kind of repressed material. How many of you, honestly, This is actually, I want you to raise your hands because then it'll make me feel better. Believed at certain times when you were a kid that there was something under your bed. Okay. Why? Because there was something under your bed. That's why. And it is actually a childhood fantasy about something that is profoundly true, which is there are things that you can't face under your bed. Both your own gifts, your wild, innate beauty and creativity, and also some of your darkness. So it appears in the form of a monster under your bed. Now, the thing about the monster under the bed is if you don't address the monster under the bed, what happens to it? It gets bigger. It gets bigger. It grows. And sometimes some cultures, like let's take Puritan culture, the Puritans, who are an integral part of why any of you are here, whether you're, you know, of that lineage or not, so constrictive around purity codes, who's in and who's out, that they literally burned human beings, females, to death because they thought they were witches. That's a refusal to look under the bed. It is. It's a refusal to look under the bed at the complexity of what the feminine is and the complexity of human nature. So we keep it under the bed, and it grows. It grows and grows and grows. Like there's Anne Belford Ulanov. She's teaches at Union Theological Seminary. She says it's like if you have an alligator that you brought home that was really cute from Florida on vacation and put it in the bathtub, you know? Well, you know, a few months are going to go by and you're going to be totally screwed. And you won't even be able to go into the bathroom to get rid of it. That's what repressed material is like. It just grows. So it eventually demands our attention, usually comes out sideways. And if we're not in the business of beginning to eat the shadow, guess what? We turn that alligator loose on everybody we don't like. Really. And just devour whole people groups and individuals as the problem. Okay, just follow, this is also from the person I just mentioned, Anne Ulanov. Listen to this progression. The line is drawn from repression to regression. We're following the line back here. From repression to regression to contamination. Isn't that interesting? Repression, regression, contamination. Contamination of unconscious contents. Two, projection and projective identification onto our alien neighbor. I'll put it in my terms. It goes under the bed. It grows. It feels like if we get close to this, we're going to be contaminated. So I take what I can't see and I project it onto the alien neighbor. It's not the monster under my bed. They're the monster. She goes on, projective identification onto our alien neighbor to attitudes of prejudice from which grow acts of oppression, persecution, and finally scapegoating. That's where the train ends. Oppression, you get hints of it. Persecution, oh, there it is, to scapegoating. And scapegoating in its darkest form from human beings is the murdering of other human beings. That if we could just, and if we could get rid of them, we'd be free of the contamination. Now, don't think you're above this. I'm not saying any of you are bet ready to go out and take some neighbor with their political signs that you disagree with and you're going to burn them at the stake. You're like, no, I wouldn't do that. But you can see the line, how it starts to move. Also an aside, also a book I'm never going to write, but COVID itself pokes around in all this stuff because it's a kind of contamination. If I told you right now I had COVID, you would feel weird. Correct? Even if there was no way you were going to get it or cause any kind, you would still feel like he's contaminated. Really, wouldn't you? Okay, now, whether I don't want to have a scientific conversation about any of that stuff. I'm just saying it pokes around in who's acceptable and who's not, who's pure and who's not. Those are very, very, very old, like 50,000-year-old dimensions of human evolution in the brain. You're not above it. You're an instinctual animal. And even the, what's it called? The, not repulsion, but there's another word for it. I can't think of it. Like if you come in contact with something and you like are suddenly revolted, there's a word for it. Repulsion, thank you. Revulsion, that's the word I'm looking for. Where does that come from? Where does that come from? Because sometimes it's rational and sometimes it's totally irrational. Because it's poking around in all this kind of who's safe and who's not, who's contaminated, who's not. If I could get rid of the contaminated people, everything would be great. So let's not just think that we're above it. All right, so I've now gotten to the point of the talk where I'm going to say there's a way out. All right? And I'm just going to mention some things. And first of all, I want to mention some things in culture, just briefly, and I challenge you to come up with your own list. Here are examples where we see cultural bits of shadow or cultural bits of scapegoating. Illegal aliens are like vermin. That was a phrase that was used. Vermin is, you know, like mice, like they're going to contaminate, which is what mice always did to things like grain. Now, that's playing along those same lines. And the irony that immigrants would say that immigrants are contaminating us. That's a classic example of disowned, repressed shadow. Here are other examples. Canceling someone because of a single tweet. That they are no longer worthy to be a human being on this earth and make a contribution because of one thing they said. That is scapegoating to the T. Let's send them out of the camp. Here are phrases that now have a scapegoating dimension. So-and-so is a socialist. Right? Or sometimes Marxist. Okay? So-and-so is a socialist. If we could get rid of them, we'd have our country back. Here's another version. So-and-so is a capitalist. It's the same thing. From an idea. Now, we could have a whole conversation about philosophy, but I'm just talking about on the level of contamination and scapegoating. If we could get rid of all the capitalists, we'd all be happy. We'd all be pure. Meanwhile, buy my sticker that says capitalism is the problem. Okay. Language policing. On either side here, because it's happening from the left and the right, language policing. Because there's a kind of fear at work. If you speak a certain way, that evokes fear in me, and that's the problem. And so as long as you don't speak this way, then I don't have to look at what I don't want to look at. Getting rid of all symbols and names with a questionable past. I saw that a school changed their name. It was named after Abraham Lincoln, and they changed the name. And I thought, this is interesting. Where does this stop? That's an example of the same kind of thing. Well, we found a flaw, so we put it on, this case, Lincoln, and send him out of the camp to be burned. And now we're free from contamination. Do you think the school is any different that they changed from Lincoln whatever to like Oak School or something that's somewhat neutral? Nothing has changed, most likely. In fact, the monster may be growing under the bed because now they don't even have to look at it. We're free of all that. Am I making sense? Okay. You can disagree with me, but not right now. Okay, so I'm going to go kind of quickly here, and I want to give you some hints about ways out of this trap that we're all likely to fall into. The first one comes again from Anne Ulanoff. She says, we need feminine consciousness. We need feminine consciousness as a way out of scapegoating. Now, how? And I'll give you some generalizations. I'm not necessarily talking about gender here. I'm talking about a consciousness, masculine and feminine consciousness. Masculine consciousness is about aim, direction, differentiation, this and not that. Who's faster? Who's stronger? It's about logos, to use a Greek word, which is order, reason, rationality. And we need all those things. What's feminine consciousness like? She says, it's about opposites that can be included. It's like the ocean tides. The ocean tide doesn't have an aim. It ebbs and flows. That's feminine consciousness, which is much more like eros. It's much more like chaos than order. Eros versus logos. She says we need more feminine consciousness. That's very interesting. Like, anyone who has ever met a mother, which is probably most of you, knows that at times there's a kind of amazing capacity to hold all kinds of things. That's that feminine consciousness. I just think that's such an interesting thing for someone to say. How do we get out of scapegoating? We need more feminine consciousness. The consciousness that can hold opposites. Interesting. Here's another example. I'm going to skip some of these. Okay. There's nothing wrong with having boundaries. There's nothing wrong with even having borders. In fact, you can't have a conversation about what's acceptable and what's not, or what's in and what's out, without a boundary, without a border. But part of what's being invited with a conversation around scapegoating is to be as clear as you can about the borders, even the borders of your own ideas, and also have a kind of fluid, open-minded relationship with them. And not bow down at them as if I know and my border is the only border and my way is the only way. We need a kind of fluid conversation around our own borders. Another way of saying is that there's nothing wrong with having an opinion or a philosophy or an idea or even an ideology. And we're responsible to a certain extent to bear witness to that. Like, if you think about your own values, you have a responsibility to bear witness to, this is how I'm living in the world and this is what I'm thinking. That's a lot different than proselytizing, for example, or coercing people into your way of being, but it's instead a call for a word that keeps coming up over the last year, a kind of humility around your own values and around your own ego's positions. Because that's really, it's the ego that wants to scapegoat. Okay, I'm going to list some things by way of challenge and then I'm done. So here it is. Number one, I want you to try to, this week, make a list of your strongest reactions around certain people. All right, make a list. Who are you reacting to very strongly? And you can start with political figures. They're easy, but they're almost too easy. But who am I around where I have a kind of unbalanced, usually negative reaction? Like, it doesn't really add up. Like, when Mitch McConnell starts talking, something goes crazy in me. I mean, not, you know, I have a friend who's like that. And try to get as close to home as you can in your list. List people in which you have strong reactions. That's number one. Number two, list out very clearly, as clear as you can, what their way of being is like. What are they like? What's their vibe? What do they say? How do they sound? What are they up to? Be as clear as you can. List it out. This person is like this. Some of it, like with people you don't know, you'll run out of things. Like, I have nothing with Mitch McConnell. He's annoying. Then I'm kind of stuck. And then it maybe might dissipate. But start listing out, really, how does this person behave in the world? That really, really irritates me. And I know they behave this way because they are this way. Have I made sense? Here's number three. Have I ever acted this way? That's where the hard work starts. Have I ever acted this way? Have I ever manipulated, lied, cheated, stole something, blamed, accused, was so rigid in my position I couldn't listen to anybody? Whatever. Have I ever done that? And be specific. Don't just say, oh, I'm sure I have. No, really, when was the last time you did it? And if you're really getting close to shadow, it was probably something you did this week. And you can't see it because it's behind you. And then here's the final question. Here's my four-step process. This is not going to fix anything. It's just going to start a conversation. Would I rather this person carry all this stuff for me so I don't have to? Or would I like to own some of it myself? See, if we don't do this kind of work, whatever we think is going on in America and in the Western world is going to get so much worse. That's the train we're on, really. Blaming, scapegoating, demonizing, and eventually destroying, that's where this goes. And I'm not being some sort of pessimist. I'm saying that's the way it is. So that's my challenge for today when it comes to scapegoating. Thanks for listening.